Welcome, everyone, to episode 408 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we are going to spend an hour discussing the eye test versus analytics. And whichever way you are listening and watching basketball, you are wrong. We will tell you why. No, today we're going to actually talk about the biggest NBA underachievers. We are almost halfway through the season, so you know some early slow starts have now ballooned into full-fledged crises for a couple of teams that were expected to be a lot better than they were. So we'll talk about those teams, what's gone wrong, whether they could be fixed this year, what it means for their long-term outlook as well. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. We are on iTunes or wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we're recording our show today on Locker Room, the only live audio social network for sports fans. Listen to our show on Locker Room before it hits your iTunes feed, engage with us in real time, or start your own room to react to the draft, trade news, and more. Take the mic and download Locker Room in the Apple App Store. Joining me today is the biggest NBA Top Shot junkie I know, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
Is there another Morten Jensen that I don't know about?
Probably. I don't know. Okay. Didn't you say there's like everyone in Denmark has the same name?
Oh, yeah, pretty much. At least Jensen or Hansen or something along those lines. Yeah.
There we go. Yeah. So before we get rolling, a programming note here, just so y'all are not caught off guard in the coming weeks. If you follow me on Twitter, a couple months ago, I announced that my wife and I are expecting our first child. Back then, we still had a few months of runway, so it was less terrifying. Now we are rapidly trying to land that plane. So she is due in a couple weeks. It will be no later than March 24th. Unfortunately, the NBA trade deadline is March 25th. So I will be out of commission for a couple episodes at least. Mort has lined up a guest host in the meantime, so we will still have the pod. We'll still have plenty of coverage leading into, during, and after the trade deadline, so no worries there. But I will not be here for at least some of that because I will be drowning and crying and baby pee.
Oh, it's adorable you think it's only pee.
I've been reading like how many diapers to expect per day, and I'm horrified. Oh boy.
You should be.
Yeah, so, and when I come back, I will be just in a world of sleep deprivation that I've never dreamed of before, but I'm excited for it. Morbidly.
Well, I'm glad you are.
Yeah. All right, cool. So let's get underway, because really this entire episode, and I hate to do this because I hate this team so much and I don't want to defend them, but this entire episode was inspired by the Boston Celtics.
Okay, before you even go further here, why is it that you hate them? Is it just because you're a Sixers fan? I have to understand this. Grudge.
It's a Boston. It's not even just Sixers and Celtics. It's like a Boston-Philly thing. But yes, we are born and bred to hate them. Like when my son will come out of the womb, and I hope his first word is F Boston.
Really? Really? Yeah. It doesn't seem like a good plan to hate an NBA team when we're conducting an NBA podcast.
Well, to be fair, I'm going to be rational about this team because the Celtics have obviously had a rough start to the year. You know, you get off to a 12-9 start and things are looking, you know, okay, but like you're still a little disappointed, but whatever. Kemba came back great. They have since gone on a major skid. They won last night against the Pacers, got a big win after falling into an 18-4 hole and looking like they're going to fall victim to a Miles Turner revenge game. So they are 16-17 right now, but they have lost 8 of their past 12. And there was a Bobby Marks tweet the other night that was like, you know, every team to win a championship has to take a big risk. What is Boston going to do? Or has their window already closed? And that's what got me. So before we get into kind of their long-term outlook, Mort, what do you think has gone wrong for the Celtics this year?
Well, let me ask you this, Brian. Has Marcus Smart played in the past 10 games? I think it's even more than that, 14 games maybe?
He has not. He has been out since the end of January. That is correct.
So let me just get this straight. So when you're missing your very best defender and a guy who's actually also a pretty big man in terms of your offensive components, look, for the 18 games that he played this year, only three of which he failed to reach double figure scoring, meaning you're actually taking a two-way guy off the court. Do you think that kind of matters a little bit? And then you add in the fact that Kemba Walker has a bad knee. Could that? I'm just spitballing here, but that might be a reason.
It seems like a mildly important point that is getting glossed over significantly in these Celtics discussions. Yeah. And I'm with you. I don't understand it. It's like, it reminds me of the Warriors, the first couple games of the year where they just got their pants blown off. It was like the first two games they got blown out by 20 points each. And everyone's like, all right, bury the Warriors. The Warriors are dead. The dynasty's over. It's like Draymond Green didn't play in either of those games. He comes back and suddenly, you know, they're not title contenders, but they're a playoff team.
Yeah, they just dropped 19 times. Yeah.
Yeah. When you're without, I think Boston fans have long said Marcus Smart is like the heart and soul of this team, which I think Draymond is probably, you know, Warriors fans feel the same way about Draymond. That's not saying they're the best player. You know, Steph is obviously the best player at Golden State. Tatum and Brown are the best players in Boston. But Marcus Smart is the tone setter on both ends of the floor. Yeah. So especially defensively, I think you're right, Mort. Being without one of your top wing defenders is certainly going to hurt when you're going against
your
a bunch
absolute
of elite
top wing defender. Let's be honest and let's be fair. I love Jalen and I love Jason, and both of them have great defensive upside, and both of them are already influential defenders. But there's no doubt in my mind, nor should there be doubt in anyone's minds, that Marcus Smart is by far Boston's best overall defender, and he is by far, far, far their best perimeter defender. This is a guy who once checked Paul Millsap in the goddamn playoffs.
That's true. That is true. And then you also mentioned Kemba, who I think we do have to talk about. He's shooting only 38.5% overall this year, 35.3% from three. He had a good game last night against the Pacers. He willed them back. He scored a season-high 32 points on 10 of 19 shooting, 4 of 8 from three, drew 8 free throw attempts, which is also a season-high for him. You know, he has been shaky. He's been missing. I don't think he's played a single back-to-back yet. I'm guessing that's going to happen for the rest of the regular season, at least. He's clearly not, you know, all-star version Kemba Walker. But I think moving forward, this is probably one of the biggest questions for the Celtics is, can he get back to that point, or what should we expect out of Kemba Walker? I don't even really care about the rest of the regular season, but come late May, do you think Kemba's going to be back to being Kemba Walker, like 80% of Kemba Walker? Where do you think Kemba comes into once we get to the playoffs?
I think you're confusing me with your wife, who's a doctor. I'm not.
Fair.
Well, I have no idea. I don't have insights into his knee, but I'll say as much. If that knee is going to be a problem, then obviously he's going to be, you know, a certain percentage of what he used to be, and that's problematic because you need to have that third guy who can come in and give you a significant portion of points, because otherwise you're just putting so much pressure on both Tatum and Brown. And that's just unfair given how young they are, especially in playoff context. So he is extremely important to their offensive success. If he's limited in any way late in the season, oh boy, that's not going to go over well.
Yeah. And I think that's probably point guard in general is one of their biggest concerns, because they signed Jeff Teague to be the main backup. Jeff Teague has been very disappointing this year. He's shooting only 34.0 from the field, 42.5 from three on low volume. You know, there's not a ton of reliable bench depth either. Peyton Pritchard has been a nice surprise. Robert Williams has a ton of upside, but he's inconsistent. Other than that, you just don't really know what you're going to get out of most of these guys every night. I mean, Semi Ojeleye is going to be, he'll play good defense, but you can't rely on him for a ton of offense. Grant Williams is a total wild card at this point. So, like, there are legit concerns with this Celtics team, front court as well. I mean, Tyson Thompson are, you know, fine, but neither are elite by any means. So, you know, more, we've been mentioning the Celtics, like, anytime we have a trade discussion over the last month. We've brought the Celtics up because they have that $28.5 million traded player exception. This week, I think Danny Ainge was the one who came out and said, you know, we might not use it this year. It carries over through the offseason. We think we'll have a better chance to use it then. What would you do if you're Ainge? Are you in a rush to fix this team now to, you know, give them their best shot of winning this year? Or do you think it makes sense to hold that thing over and kind of balance the short and the long term of this team?
No, I'm not like Bobby Marks, who thinks that they have to go all in right now. I wasn't even like trying to land a jab, but he's one of those guys who said that, you know, there's a sense of urgency, and I don't agree with that. I think ultimately the two guys you know you're moving forward with, and I bring them up multiple times almost at every episode, that's Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, both of whom are super young. I just don't see why you would look at the pieces around those two and go, oh yeah, we need to accelerate everything around them. I mean, right now, they have a perfectly fine running mate in Marcus Smart when he's healthy. By the way, fun fact, Marcus Smart is not even 27 yet. It feels like he's been in the league for 15 years.
Yeah.
He's not even 27, so he will be very, very shortly, but he's young enough to grow with those two guys. You just got a ton of draft picks in during the last draft. You know, Pritchard is there. Aaron Nesmith is there. You have Robert Williams from a previous, a couple years ago draft. Like, they're guys that who you can grow with. Mm-hmm. Are they going to be difference makers? I don't know, but it's at least a start. It's one of those reasons why I wasn't necessarily that keen when they brought in Kemba and they still had Gordon Hayward, because it felt like they were, and you and I talked about that as well, like they had a foot in each camp, which on the surface was fine because it taught the youngsters how to win. Yeah. But at the same time, you just allocated so much money to guys who wouldn't be relevant when Tatum and Brown like get into their primes. So I think what they need to do is sit down and figure out how can we optimize our salary structure, how can we best build around Tatum and Brown, what can we do as an NBA organization to actually mold this team in the right way. Now, let's say Orlando is open to accepting a very limited return for Nikola Vucevic, mm-hmm. then I think you do it right now, as soon as that trade is available, if it is. And then you just say, screw it. And I realize Vucevic is going to be 31, but that's just such a drastic talent injection that you could make the argument that that would be enough for a finals appearance this year, mm-hmm. pending, again, Kemba. So, like, if the organization is going, we don't trust Kemba's knee, We think even if we pull the trigger on a Vooch deal or an Aaron Gordon deal or Harrison Barnes deal or whatever, we just think that Kemba's knee is such a problem that we might actually be wasting this opportunity by going all in on a CP8 target. Mm-hmm. Then I think it's fair to just go into the offseason and say, you know what, let's arm ourselves with patience. Let's see what we can do. Let's see if we can get Kemba's knee right. Or maybe we need to necessitate a trade. And then from there, you figure stuff out. Another thing that hasn't been brought up much, I don't think it's been brought up at all. It's something that hit me late last night. Theoretically, the Celtics could take on multiple guys off that CBE. So mm-hmm. what about taking just a crap contract somewhere through the CPE? And another like really positive young guy as compensation for taking on a bad contract through the TPE.
Yeah, certainly a possibility. I mean, I'm with you, and I can understand why the last couple years have raised the win now expectations for Boston, because you could really argue they should have made at least one finals appearance in the last couple years. Whether it was against, I mean, Cleveland, probably not, when they were, you know, without Kyrie and Hayward. But last year, I think it's pretty safe to say they were favored against Miami, and they just got upset in the Eastern Conference Finals. But again, you said it, like, Jaylen Brown turned 24 in October. Jason Tatum turns 23 in a couple days here.
No, Jason Tatum is 19.
Yeah, always 19. Always, yeah. 19. 19 going on 23 in a couple days. But these guys are just still so young, and they continue to... If they were already plateauing, I'd be concerned. But both of them have continued to add to their game significantly every year of their career, really. I mean, Tatum, like, quote-unquote plateaued from year one to year two, and it was like, oh, what if he already hit a ceiling because he went to Duke and they're so polished? And then they take these massive leaps the next 2 years, and like, no, that was really stupid. That was, yeah, you can't say that about a 20-year-old. So yeah, I'm just not that concerned, even if they can't fix this team this year. And I'm right with you in terms of the TPE as well. Like, if you can get a major upgrade, go for it. But would I give up a first-round pick for, like, Rudy Gay, who I think would be a help for this team, but he's on an expiring contract and he's in his 30s?
No.
Yeah, like, is not going to be a long-term part of this franchise? No. I can't imagine a move they make this year that makes them favored over all three of Brooklyn, Philly, and Milwaukee, who I think are pretty clearly the three best teams in the East at this point. But, right. I mean, I was thinking about it watching that Pacers game, like, if Kemba is back to being Kemba, you get Marcus Smart back, doesn't this team actually somewhat match up well against Brooklyn?
Like, yeah,
if you have Tatum, Brown, and Smart, those three guys defensively, it's kind of what you need against Brooklyn.
And one more thing as well, and that's Robert Williams. So, mm-hmm, you know how you brought it up as well, you know, he's been inconsistent and all that.
Yeah.
I think more so in terms of, like, weird roster construction and almost trades and whatnot, I think one thing we haven't talked a whole lot about is what role the Celtics have played in him not becoming what we thought he would be. I think it's easy for players to become inconsistent if they are receiving inconsistent minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at a guy like Robert Williams, even if you go back to last season, the most he played last season was 22 minutes in a game. And the same thing has remained true this year.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, how are you have not created the right circumstances for him to actually play enough minutes to learn from his mistakes and play through his mistakes. So I think there is potentially a starting caliber center waiting right there who might actually be ready if he was just given the minutes and he didn't have to look over his shoulder all the time. And yes, he would absolutely have a period where he had to adjust and where he would make a lot of boneheaded mistakes. Mm-hmm. But it's fine. You need to invest. I mean, they invested the time in Tatum and Brown. Why not Robert Williams? And if they do that for the rest of the season, and by, I don't know, late April, May or something, he suddenly proves to be a perfectly fine starting caliber center, then that only enhances their odds against a team like Brooklyn.
Yeah, I mean, he had a great game against Indiana last night. 14 points, 11 rebounds, 4 assists, 3 blocks, and only 22 minutes. And
he's really good.
And they're approaching decision time with him. He becomes eligible for an extension this offseason. So they kind of need to figure out what they have in him and whether he can be, you know, kind of a long-term piece of this puzzle next to Tatum and Brown. So I'm right with you there as well.
It's just a matter of really giving him a chance, I think. I mean, look, when you also look at his shot selection, obviously he's not a shooter, but he understands his role. The guy has never shot below 70% from the field during his three NBA seasons. If that doesn't tell you that he understands, at the very least, where to take his shots, I don't know what does.
Yeah, totally agree. So, I mean, it sounds like overall you and I are just not really concerned about the Celtics either this year or long term.
Why would I be worried when they have Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown? That's such a preposterous idea that I cannot get behind it. I don't know why people are hitting the panic button. I don't know why I have Celtics fans on my YouTube channel saying Danny Ainge doesn't care about this team. He wants it to fail. Like, what in the actual hell? Like, no. No, that's not like, yeah, he made some horrific mistakes here and there, absolutely. But I don't think anyone, you know, on the Celtics roster, in their front office, on the coaching staff, actively wants the team to fail. Like, what a load of crock.
Right, yeah. Having one two-way wing, one young, elite two-way wing, is like the cheat code in today's NBA. The Celtics have two. They have the hardest thing. It's like in the NFL. Like, getting a young, elite quarterback is the hardest thing to do. If you have that, you build around them, and you have a good foundation. The Celtics have a great foundation that, honestly, 20-plus teams, 25-plus teams would probably trade places with them right now.
If we're it's just actually about- easy to get a good quarterback in the NFL. You just don't draft Mitch Trubisky.
you do whatever the Chicago Bears wouldn't do. And then
right, gonna, exactly. Yeah, then otherwise, you know, Patrick Mahomes, right there.
All right, let's move on to the Denver Nuggets, who another team that made it to the conference finals last year and another team that is barely in playoff position this year. They are 17-15, currently the 8th seed in the West, despite Nikola Jokic having an MVP caliber season. Mm-hmm. What has gone wrong for this Nuggets team?
I think you and I have covered it pretty well over the past year. Nuggets fans don't agree with us. I've learned that they lost a ton of talent. I'm not really sure how they can look at that roster and actually disagree with that notion, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. But they are, for some reason, under that belief. But they got worse. They lost just a ton of talent. Like, they don't necessarily have enough defense, enough depth. Even their scoring is like very reliant upon Jokic and Murray, I feel like. Mm-hmm. Everyone else is sort of, not. Monte Morris, I feel, when I watch him play, I have a different sense about him now than I usually did before. Because with him, I could be nervous about him, you know, scoring at a productive and consistent level. I actually feel more confident with him when I watch him now. But Michael Porter Jr., inconsistent. Will Barton, yeah, a little bit inconsistent as well. Paul Millsap is 785,000 years old. That's just not something I'm totally reliant upon if I'm the Nuggets. You know, Jamichael Green has been decent, but I don't think he's a major difference maker, as some people try to make it out. Campacho has been fine. Signacci has come along, but it's slow progress in that regard. I just don't think they have enough, man. I think overall that's their issue. I don't think it's something specifically that has gone wrong over the course of the year. I think they're just short on talent.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you can argue they haven't. When you lose Malik Beasley, Jeremy Grant, Mason Plumlee, those three guys alone in the span of less than a calendar year.
Yeah.
That's a lot of talent out that they... Okay, cool, like Campacho and Jamichael Green, as you said, they're fine. They're not replacements for the caliber of guys you lost. So, yeah, I think their depth was one of the things that made them so good in years past, and they just don't have that anymore. So, you know, despite Jokic having an MVP caliber season, they need something else. Like, Gary Harris just continues to be an enigma at this point. I mean, once seemed like he was on the trajectory to be kind of a, I don't want to say elite 3-and-D guy, but, you know, really solid complementary player a couple years ago. He's now down to 32% shooting this year. He's still not taking a high volume of threes either. You know, scoring fewer points than he has since his rookie year. It's a bummer, but it's just like that, yeah. You know, it seems like the ship is starting to sail on him being a really productive member of that rotation, or being not productive, but reliable, like a reliable number three or number four guy. I don't know that it's going to happen.
To be fair to Harris though, like let's just preface this by saying injuries.
Yeah. Of
because
course.
He was there. He used to be there. He was what, a 17 point scorer at some point. Let me just look that up. Yeah, 17.5 points per game. That was the year you alluded to. Like he had that. He was there, and then the injuries just kept coming. So this is not about him declining necessarily as a player, like in terms of skill or dedication. This is just a guy who's been ravaged by injuries.
Yeah. And Jamal Murray started the year, I don't want to say cold necessarily, because he, over his first 22 games, he averaged 18 points a game on 44% shooting, 34 from three. But he's really caught fire over, you know, since mid-February. Over his last eight, he's up to 30.6 points, 54.7% shooting, 48.7 from deep. This is the version we've seen over the past 2 weeks. This is bubble Jamal Murray. This is the guy, like, playoff mode Jamal Murray. This is the guy they need him to be with the rest of the supporting cast just not pulling its weight.
I would agree. This is the guy that they need as to not get into a situation where they feel compelled to trade for a Bradley Beal or a Zach LaVine or someone of that caliber, because this is the type of guy that they could just use. Now, personally, I think what we're seeing from him, you know, when he is more of a scorer than he is a facilitator, I think that's just another example of him functioning better as a guy who just moves off the ball. That's why I really love how the Nuggets have embraced point Jokic to the same extent. I think so many teams would have been so scared of doing that just years ago. So for the Nuggets to go all in and say, you know what, we trust Nikola with the ball to the point where he can set everyone up. We know we have Jamal Murray, who is, you know, traditionally, if we go by positions, a shooting guard, not really a point guard. He can run around screens. He can move off the basketball, and he can get shots in that manner. That's working. They just need more of that type of guy.
Right. And overall, between Jokic and now Murray, offense is not really the problem for them. They're fifth in the league in terms of offensive rating. Defense is the problem for them. They're 21st. And that leads me to, we need to have the Michael Porter Jr. talk. He is currently 84th out of 89 small forwards in ESPN's defensive real plus minus. The scoring upside is there. He shows these flashes still, and you're like, this guy, if he hits, this is the X factor. This is the guy that cements Denver as a long-term title threat. But it just seems like Mike Malone does not trust this kid at all.
Would you?
No, but at a certain point, you have to let him sink or swim, I think.
He's getting 28 minutes a game. This isn't a Robert Williams situation.
I know, but it's 28 minutes a game. Like, if you're not going to go out of your way to re-sign Jeremy Grant because you're saying we need to make more minutes, more opportunity for Michael Porter Jr., and then you're like, okay, cool. He played 40 minutes the other night. Great. Mm-hmm. He played 19 minutes against Atlanta two games prior.
Well, I mean, this is a question of what he's producing, right? If he's just not in it, he's a guy who really is all about the rhythm game. If he starts a game without a rhythm, he's essentially worthless. And that sounds really harsh, but he is. He has to be locked in. He has to be engaged. He has to have this whole dynamic working for himself. And when he doesn't, he's just standing around. He's not really active. I will say this, though. He's only played 77 career games. There is still time for all of that. He's 22 years old. He essentially missed two seasons as well. So there is, I don't want to say that last season was, you know, I don't want to make apologies on his behalf by saying that it was a period where he had to like get reacclimated to the game and whatnot, because there was that big break in between the season because of the coronavirus pandemic, and I think in that space, you know, that's where you have a chance to mentally reset, and I think he did that. So you could argue in some ways this is his real third season that he's going into. But he's just not picked it up in that way, and I think it's fine to just, you know, carry some patience with this guy. I would be more concerned about the locker room issues, honestly, more than anything, or just how he meshes with teammates. That's something I would be more worried about. I think the talent level is there, but something we never really talk about is you also need to be well-liked by your teammates in order to succeed. And I'm not basing this off of intel or anything, but does people like him?
I mean, so there is the possession the other night, the end-of-game possession, where they're down two against the Wizards. They get a rebound. Jamal Murray runs it up the court. It's a three-on-one fast break or four-on-one fast break.
And the guy back was Bradley Beal, right?
Right. So Jamal, like, he picks up Jamal Murray, and Michael Porter Jr. has an entire court's worth of space. There is no one there to defend him. But rather than run for a layup or a lob or a dunk, he comes out to the three-point line. So does Campacho. Murray passes Campacho and misses the shot. I mean, it was just one of the lowest IQ basketball plays I've seen in quite some time. And, you know, the afterward, there was like, should Mike Malone have called a timeout? No. They had a 3-on-1 fast break. No, he should not have called a timeout. You know, people started posting the screenshot. Matt Moore of the Action Network did. I saw a couple other people. But then I saw Jamal Murray post the screenshot. And it was a screenshot from the other end of the court. And he was like, this angle. And it is showing Michael Porter Jr. standing at the three-point arc with no one between him and the basket.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bradley Beal up on Jamal Murray. I'm like, that, for Jamal Murray to be tweeting that seems like a not-so-subtle subtweet of Michael Porter Jr.'s basketball intelligence.
Yep.
So what do you think the Nuggets do here? Because it's, I mean, it's a really tricky situation. Like, if they're going to make a big trade, if they're going to make a big swing, Michael Porter Jr. is the piece they have to include. No team is going to trade a Bradley Beal or a Zach LaVine without getting Michael Porter Jr. back.
Well, I mean, I have to be careful what I say about the Nuggets, apparently.
That's right. Well, we're not saying Jokic is getting traded. We're saying they would get another co-star for Jokic. But, I mean, you know, the Nuggets are in a similar spot with MPJ that Boston is with Robert Williams, just, you know, a supersized version of it. Because, again, Michael Porter Jr., this is his third year. He'll be up for an extension this offseason. We are approaching decision time with him. As you said, they don't have a ton of data to base that decision off. He missed his first year, played very sparingly last year. Mm-hmm. Like, do you feel confident in this kid as your third co-star?
No. He's played 1,500 minutes. I don't feel sure about anything. I don't feel comfortable about anything with him. And look, you know, as much as I want to avoid this subject, we just have to take into account the distraction that he is from a media perspective as well. That factor, no, but it does, Brian. Like, you know it does, because if he's getting headlines for all the dumb reasons, that's going to portray the Nuggets in a bad light. It's going to it shouldn't, but it's going to, because that's how media works. It's going to portray his teammates in a bad light. Again, it shouldn't, but that's how it works. And like, ultimately, if this is a guy who keeps getting headlines for a bunch of just moronic reasons, you have to take into account, is this a guy we actually trust moving forward? Is he worth the headache?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, he's not. Like, right now, at this stage of his development, he's absolutely not. But he's 22, he's insanely gifted, he's superbly athletic, he's got the three ball. I understand why they're sticking to him right now, because the upside is ridiculous. But no, if you're asking me if I feel confident in extending him after this season, hell no. I would much rather make sure that when I go into those potential negotiations, that I know in my back pocket what I have in terms of trade offers.
Yeah.
And then I would gauge it. Then I would just look at, well, okay, so what do you want financially? And if he and his agent goes, well, we want a max, then I'm pulling up those trade offers immediately, and I'm going to go, okay, Michael, you know what? That's a great meeting. Let me think it over. And I'm going to call the guy with the best offer, and then that's it.
Right. You call Washington immediately. You're like, do you want this to be your problem now? Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah. But I mean, look, it's a tough situation. I'm really not trying to make it sound like it's an easy thing. It's not. I think... I think there's just so many components to him that is troublesome and that is still intriguing. Like, he's an enigma in that way. Like, he personally, and like from a personality standpoint, I've spoken to guys who've covered him who have said, just no, awful human being. Mm-hmm. And then I've spoken to those exact same people in terms of, you know, Michael Porter Jr., the player, and they've said super, super exciting, tremendous upside. I could be one of the league's most versatile offensive forwards in over the next 10 to 15 years. Like, that is just like, it's almost like the Nuggets have this, like, you know, devil on one side on their shoulder and then the angel on the other one with him. And I think it's just, you have to make sure that you get both arguments in and then you make a informed and educated decision on him moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tricky either way for sure. But I mean, that's, I don't even care what happens to them this year. Like, they're going to make the playoffs, I assume. I don't really care right. How far they go. I mean, that's the Michael Porter Jr. question is the biggest thing hanging over them for the next year, and there is not a close second.
Agreed. I do care a little bit what happens this year because, and this is where I'll bring it up, you know, Jokic can be a free agent in 2 years.
Oh, no.
No. I'm not going to bring up a certain team. I'm just saying okay. He can leave in 2 years. Mm-hmm. You don't want to waste his time. That's what I'm saying. Over the next 2 years, if the Nuggets don't get back to where they were from a talent perspective a couple years ago, I think you are running the risk of putting yourself in a situation where Jokic will be looking at what he's got on that team in terms of running mates. And if the only thing truly that he has working for him in that sense is Jamal Murray, then Jamal Murray better have turned into a top 15 player in the meantime.
Yeah, that's fair. And hey, in the meantime, they could be, right now they have Utah in the first round, so maybe they could pull an 8-1 upset and all is fixed.
Yeah, no, but it's tricky. Denver is tricky. They really are. But I don't think it's a problem for this year.
No, I don't either. So let's go to a team where they got off to a very slow start, but it's now bounced back because the East is so confusing and there's only one game separating the fourth seed from the 10th seed. Currently occupying the fifth seed are the Miami Heat at 16-17.
I mean,
for me, this is another team where I am just so, words cannot express how unconcerned I am about them.
No, but to reiterate the East, I actually have a pretty good example of how you can sum that up. Going into the Suns game last night, the Bulls were the sixth seed. Then they lost that one game to Phoenix, and now they're in the ninth seed.
And Miami was the 10th seed coming into last night, right? And now they're the fifth?
Oh, God, were they? Jesus.
I think I saw like Tim Reynolds or someone tweet that out.
This could be the most exciting playoff run, or not playoff run, but like run towards the playoffs we've ever seen.
Yeah, because, I mean, especially given the importance of a top six seed so you can avoid the play-in tournament, you've got seven teams jockeying for three spots right now.
Yeah.
And they're all that close to one another. So, yeah, it's right. Saying the Heat are the fifth seed makes it sound a lot better. But, yeah, I guess I should have put that in perspective. It's saying they were the 10th seed coming into last night. They won one game against Utah, which is huge for them. But for Miami, I mean, losing Jay Crowder certainly hurt this offseason. But I think the obvious reason they've struggled to start the year is injuries and COVID. I mean, Jimmy Butler has missed 12 games. Jimmy Butler's missed 12. Tyler Hero's missed 11. Goran Dragic has missed 14. Those three guys alone are three of your top six players, right?
Yeah. For sure.
The end. Dragic is back, Butler's back, and can we address the Butler All-Star stuff for a second?
Mm-hmm.
No one is arguing that Jimmy Butler is not an All-Star caliber player.
Like, agreed.
You know, when Sabonis got named as KD's replacement to the All-Star game, I saw, you know, John Hollinger of The Athletic and a couple of, like, Miami people are like, this is an insult. Jimmy Butler is still alive. It's like, we're aware, But he missed a ton of time.
Yeah.
And this is not, like, the All-Star game has never been who are the X most talented players regardless of condition. It is who has had the, you know, best season up until this point. And when you miss a third of the season and you don't, like, I know KD has too, but he got voted in. That's different. And he's not playing the game anyway.
I would not have taken KD into the game if he had, like, the current games played scenario right now.
Right. I don't think anyone is saying Jimmy Butler is not an All-Star caliber player. It's just he had missed a ton of time this year. So it's not an insult to leave him out of the game because of that. But when healthy, he is clearly the Heat's best player still, with all due respect to Bam, who is also fantastic and also is deserving of an All-Star bid.
Jimmy Butler is a superstar. I have banged that drum for years.
Yeah.
I am not about to not do it this year either. He's even better this year than he was last year. I mean, look, the guy is averaging 20 and almost 8-8 while still playing fabulous defense. Look, 8-8, Brian. That's ridiculous.
Those are career highs in both categories.
Both, yeah. So obviously he's still worthy. Obviously he's still one of the absolute top-tier guys in the Eastern Conference. Had he played the entire season, or maybe just missed, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 games, he would have been a shoo-in. Honestly, I probably would have been pissed off if he wasn't named a starter.
Mm-hmm.
He's that good. He is that good. And I don't think anyone who knows basketball are saying otherwise.
Right. This is not overlooking Jimmy Butler, the talent. It is you're overlooking he missed 3 weeks of the season in a condensed season. That is the issue.
Jimmy Butler is better than James Harden, and now I've said it.
Ooh.
No, I don't care.
Just
don't
drop the grenade and walk away.
I don't care. I firmly believe it, and I think I'm right. Defense matters. I understand that offense is better than defense, but I don't think the disparity between their offense is so great as the defensive is. Like, it's Jimmy's defense compared to Harden is, I mean, it's David and Goliath. It's incomparable. And given how Jimmy also functions as a playmaker, what he does in the glass, what he does in getting to the line, how he incorporates himself, I don't care. Jimmy Butler, give me a 7-game series, and I'm taking Jimmy Butler over James Harden.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully.
All my gems are gone now, I imagine.
Well, hopefully we get to see that in the playoffs.
Yeah.
I mean, given how this thing could shake out. I was saying this last night. Like, I know people are dunking on the East because there are only 3 teams above 500 at the moment, which is fair compared to the West, you know. But I think, A, that's going to even out over time. I think, you know, some of the Orlandos and Clevelands of the world are just going to fall off a cliff a bit. And, you know, the Toronto, Miami, now that they're getting back to full strength, Boston too, when Marcus Smart comes back, Indiana, if LeVert and TJ Warren come back.
Right.
Those teams, I think, will start to separate themselves from this pack a little bit. But if they do, we're going to have one of the Sixers, Nets, Bucks, Raptors, Heat, Celtics, and Pacers will not be a top 6 seed. One of those teams, at least, will be in the play-in tournament. And we could be looking at a first round Nets Heat series or Nets Celtics or Sixers, one of those two. You know, like, there are going to be a really good matchups in the first round of the Eastern Conference playoffs, or at least there could be if the bracket breaks right. So yep. I think that's going to make the Eastern Conference playoffs even scarier, and it's going to make these teams toward the top, it's really going to increase the importance of them getting that number one seed. You know, for the West, for Utah, it's like you want the number one so you can force Clippers and Lakers into the 2 and 3 and make them play each other in the second round. For the East, it's, well, crap, we don't want to play Toronto or Miami or Boston or Indiana in the first round just because they were hurt for some part of the year and got off to slow starts. That sucks.
You know what I'm reminded of right now? I'm reminded of that scene in The Dark Knight where the Joker snaps that, what do you call it in English? I don't even know. Billiards.
Pool stick, yeah.
The pool stick in half. and throws it down on the floor and goes, says, make it quick. Yeah. I feel that's what Utah is doing to the Los Angeles team.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We'll play one of you, just not both.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so for Miami, I'm not concerned about them moving forward. I think the win against Utah last night, I would have said this even without that, but especially that. Also, I don't want to praise this guy too much given the off-court issues with him, but on-court, Kendrick Nunn, after doing nothing for the first 3 weeks of the season, has really gotten back to what he did last year. I know, you know, start the season, they put Tyler Hero in the starting lineup, and they were using him in that, like, secondary ball handler point guard role, especially with Jimmy out. They've put Nunn back into the starting lineup, which is what they did during the regular season last year. Hero and Dragic are coming off the bench. It just worked for them. It's a really well-balanced lineup now. And I think, you know, Spo was probably trying to... We talked about it earlier in the year. He was trying to, like, expand Tyler Hero's game and skill set, see, you know, test him during the regular season, because who gives a damn? But then they fell into such a big hole. Now he's like, okay, we got to go back to what works. Yep. We'll get into the playoffs. We'll get comfortably, you know, situated above that top six. Then we can mess around a little bit again. But do I think the Heat are going to go back to the finals? No, not necessarily. The top of the East is very good this year. Do I think they're not a playoff team? Absolutely not. And do I think they have anything to be really concerned about moving forward? No, definitely not.
Well, I wouldn't rule it out. I think the East is still wide open, right? I mean,
yeah.
I understand that Philly got better, but I'm not looking at like a Philly-Miami series at any point and going, oh yeah, that's automatically Philly's.
Oh no, me neither. There's no team I will feel that way about for Philly until it's proven otherwise.
Unless, of course, it's the Knicks.
Yeah, probably true.
Yeah.
Probably true. Okay. Let's move, Mort. We've talked about this team. We talked about them last episode, and we talked about them a decent amount this year. The Dallas Mavericks, who, again... We picked, both of us heading into the season, picked Luka as our MVP. And if the Mavericks were performing better, if they had a better record, we would look really good. Because he's putting up absurd MVP caliber numbers. 28.5 points, 9 assists, 8.4 rebounds. The three ball is coming around too recently.
Right, but remember when I said when we picked him, I said this is what I did with Vince Carter as well when he headed into his... third year.
Yeah. Well, but you didn't jinx Luka. You just jinxed the rest of his team.
Still. By the way, he's 22 tomorrow, that old man Luka Doncic.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, he probably peaked already, so.
Yeah. Hope, but no, I was thinking 22, right? That makes you somewhat the same age of a college senior. So yep. I'm actually thinking that now we can give him a chance to go up against, like, Ohio State or something.
Oh, true, yeah. The NCAA tournament starts in a few weeks. So right. Now so it's just, time to shine.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, Luka, over the last 9 games, shooting almost 48% from 3 on 8.1 attempts per game, hit the killer step back against Boston to close them out, had a couple big ones against Philly the other night as well. So... I think it's safe to say we are not concerned about Luka Doncic. Ben Simmons will not put him in prison every night, luckily for him.
Yeah.
We talked a ton about Kristaps last episode, so I don't think we need to go too far into that. If you want to hear a bunch of Kristaps talk, just check out the last episode. Obviously, it's a big issue for them, but you know, we covered territory there. What else stands out to you as a reason that this team has struggled this year?
Lack of talent. I know people won't necessarily associate Seth Curry with you know, a high level of talent, more so just than shooting prowess.
Yep.
But he has. Shooting is also a skill, and when you're one of the very best at it in the entire world, I think that matters. And having... You know, someone else but him run to the corners and space the floor is just not the same thing. he opened up their entire offense. He kept defensive honest, and now that he's not there anymore, and I get what they wanted to do, Dallas. They wanted to round out their game a little bit more. They wanted to get in more defense with Josh Richardson. I get it. Mm-hmm. But I was skeptical when they made the trade. I said as much. I said I really hate seeing Seth Curry leave. I don't think that's going to go over well, and it hasn't. And I'm not putting everything at the feet of him leaving, but I'm putting a damn large chunk of it on that because he just changed their entire outlook. And now that he's not there, you just don't have that same gravity.
Well, when you bring Josh Richardson in to help bolster your defense, ideally he would not be 104th out of 119 players in defensive real plus minus. This is just shooting guards.
Right.
He is one spot below Corey Joseph of Sacramento, whose corpse is scheduled to be exhumed next week. So that is not great. And I just don't know the nice way to phrase this about Josh Richardson. But he feels like a player who is better conceptually than he is actually. Like, yes. he in theory, he is, you know, the complimentary 3-and-D guy. Because he's athletic, he can play defense, and he can hit threes. But in practice, after going, you know, his three-point percentage has steadily descended over the last 4 years. He hit 37.8 in 27-18 with Miami. That dropped to 35.7 the next year, 34.1 during his one season in Philly. He is now shooting a career low 30.1% despite being fed by Luka Doncic, which is the exact opposite of what happened with Tim Hardaway Jr. last year. He is still a threat in transition because of his athleticism, but in a half-court setting, I don't want Josh Richardson with a live dribble. His decision-making is just so strange at times. Like, Seth Curry forced him into a 24-second violation on the first possession of the game the other night. That just should not happen.
I agree.
And so, yeah, I mean, I also agree, like, I see what they were doing, right? They had elite, like, all-time historically great offense last year, but the defense was such a concern, so they tried to swap offense for defense and get Richardson in. I get it. But yeah, I'm with you. It feels like that move backfired, and the defense hasn't been better. They're 26th right now in terms of defensive rating.
Yeah.
Like, it just did not work as anticipated. That's not all Josh Richardson's fault. We talked about Kristaps last episode. His mobility is just not there yet. So that isn't helping either. Dwight Powell coming off the Achilles is not the same player he was previously. I mean, Dorian Finney-Smith, Maxi Kleber, great role players, but...
Well, Finney-Smith, let's actually talk about Finney-Smith. Okay. He was a lot better last year, and I mean a lot better, and it looked like that was going to be the new norm for him. Last season when they played... I think I must have tweeted like 150 times exclusively about his progress, because but it was legitimately good, Brian. Like he was starting to actually make a few plays off the dribble as well. Like, he was actually embracing a type of Draymond thing, like where he moves up a position and like he makes the right reads and he plays defense, hard nose, rebounds, you know, hits shots. And this year it's just not been that. He's bricked a lot more. He looks less comfortable out there. His rebounding has really not been an asset for him this year as well. He's afraid to put the ball on the floor. I just have no answer for what has happened with Dorian Finney-Smith. I thought he was on the upwards trajectory, and he's just not this year. And I think they would look dramatically better if it hadn't been for his decline, regression, whatever you want to call it.
Interesting. Okay.
He's good. I mean, he was one of those key players last year. Yeah. But this could be the ripple effect. And like, again, not to harp on the Seth Curry thing, but the gravity that Seth had also for, it didn't just free up Luka, you know, it freed up everyone else as well. So if Dorian Finney-Smith was on, you know, the weak side of where, you know, in the different corner, like let's say Seth Curry ran up to the right corner and Dorian Finney-Smith ran to the left corner. Okay. You know what? Nobody is nearing Finney-Smith at that point. If the action is Luka and Seth on the right wing, and if there's a quick pass to the left corner, that defense is going to travel a much longer distance to get out to Finney-Smith. They don't need to do that this year. They don't.
Right.
Are they scared of Josh Richardson and his 30% from outside? No!
They shouldn't be if they are.
Right. No, but they're not. And I think this is the problem by trading in offense for defense and whatnot. Like, I get it. I get the point of what they're trying to do. But if you have an historically great offense, run with that.
Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, if you're going to sub out offense for defense, you better make sure the guys that you're bringing in for defense are similarly elite in that skill. Like Seth right. Curry is Josh Richardson in a vacuum as an all-around basketball player might be more talented than Seth Curry, but Seth Curry does one thing really, really well, and having him just locked into that specialist role might bring more value to your team.
Right, which ironically is the exact argument I made when we discussed Seth Curry versus Steven Adams.
Right. I remember those mm-hmm. times. Good times. Yep. I will say one positive for Dallas has been the play of Jalen Brunson, who has just been yes. fantastic this year.
He has. I was waiting for this. He's solid. He's rock solid. He came into the league very polished. And last year, when he was only getting, you know, the 17, 18 minutes per game or whatever the number was, I was a little bit complexed by that. Of course, they had Dorrell Wright and whatnot, but I wanted him to get more burn. I thought offensively he could give them a push, and this year he's hit that. But he's just—I think the impact could have been greater if, you know, all the other pieces that we just talked about hadn't happened. Like if mm-hmm. Seth Curry had kept around, or if Josh Richardson had just lived up to expectations, you know, I could have seen Jalen Brunson have an even better year than what he's having right now.
Yeah, I mean, he's averaging career-high 12.3 points, shooting a career-best 52.4 overall, 42.4 from three, or 42.2 from three, sorry.
88 from the line. He's super close to 50-40-90.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could make an argument that he's been their third-best, second-best player, like him and Tim Hardaway, two and three in some order.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So we have not expressed a ton of concern about really Boston, a bit about Denver, but not a ton. Miami, none. What about the Mavericks?
Well, I mean, we covered them a little bit a couple weeks ago, and no, actually, it was last time. God, it was just a couple days ago. Mm-hmm. I'm just nervous for the long haul for them because, like I said last time, free agency options, there aren't many. They don't have like the components right now this year to turn their current season around to the point where anyone would feel comfortable with them, you know, making a deep run into the playoffs. Mm-hmm. This is a matter of, in my opinion, just letting the kids get as much burn as you can. And see what you have in them, and see who of those guys could be long-term pieces around Luka. Then you take phone calls on Porzingis. You don't actively shop him on, because otherwise, if you do, that's trade value is going to be hurt by it. And then you go into 2021 looking to make, I don't want to say modest upgrades, but I don't think you'd try to go for an overhaul when there are no players on the market that really, you know, does that for you. Mm-hmm. So you see if you can win in the margins, and then you come back next year and you have one of those holdover years, and then 2022 and 2023, that's when they can get serious about trying to upgrade the roster.
Yeah, I mean, so much of this hinges on Kristaps and whether he can get back to even, 80% of the player that we thought he was going to be during those first couple seasons in New York, and how the injuries affect him, especially defensively. But yeah, I'm with you. I don't, unless Kristaps becomes that version of himself again.
Yeah.
I struggle to see how they could even win a playoff series.
Yeah, Luka would have to take over.
Yeah, like Utah, Clippers, Lakers, if we assume those guys are penciled into the top three, I don't think Dallas is going to rise to the 4-5 mix, which like Phoenix, Portland, Golden State, Denver, Spurs. Maybe they could beat one or two of those teams, but I just don't like their chances this year.
I don't either. And something I'm just realizing now as well, and that's not for this year, Jalen Brunson is about to get paid.
Yep.
Because this is his third year. They have a fourth-year option, but he was a second-round draft pick. So they have to decline that option to actually turn him into a restricted free agent.
He and Gary Trent Jr. are going to be my two guys that no one talks about going into free agency, who I would just pay a stupid amount of money.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree.
All right, so let's wrap up with the New Orleans Pelicans, Mort, who are currently the 11th seed in the West at 14-18. They are a game and a half out of even the play-in tournament mix right now. I think it was fair to expect some degree of setback when you trade away Drew Holiday and don't, you got Steven Adams effectively and Eric Bledsoe for Drew Holiday, which, okay, but Drew Holiday is really, really good. Brandon Ingram is basically doing exactly what he did last year. Zion has just turned into an efficiency machine. I mean, his scoring around the rim in particular, he's just almost unstoppable. Lonzo has actually got off to a slow start, but since the start of February, he's averaging almost 17 points a game on 46.5% shooting, 48 from three on almost 8 attempts per game.
Yeah.
So, like, the individual main pieces are actually playing pretty well here. Why isn't this translating into wins?
Yeah, one is youth coming off the bench as well. I don't think they have a strong bench per se. JJ is getting older, not as reliable. Josh Hart is not a guy who'll go get his own. He's a really solid fundamental piece, a foundation piece, but that's it. Nikhil Alexander Walker has been good-ish, but efficiency-wise has really struggled. Kyra Lewis, who I really believe in, has also had some efficiency issues. Jackson Hayes just hasn't played a whole lot. You need a hopeful team, and I just don't think they have that right now. When you look at the top tier level, it's Ingram and Zion, obviously, but there's a drop off after that in terms of guys who can create their own shots. You could argue that Eric Bledsoe can, but you could also argue you never want him to.
Mm-hmm.
Lonzo is not a self creator, we know that. Steven Adams is more of a garbage man. So when it comes to live dribbles, in terms of like attacking off the dribble, defenses are keying in on Ingram and Zion, and they're basically letting everyone else beat them. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, because it really hinges on how they're shooting. Like Lonzo has been on fire recently, that's helped, but you're not really that afraid of Bledsoe. You're not afraid of Steven Adams. You're not super afraid of Josh Hart either. Like they just need more shooting talent, they need more size, they need a bunch of things to really build properly around Ingram and Williamson. So what I think right now is what we're seeing is like step one. Mm-hmm. They are accumulating assets, and now they're building up those assets, and in the coming years they'll flip those assets for something that makes more sense for Brandon and Zion. As long as they don't make any quote unquote Seth Curry for Josh Richardson deal, I think they'll be okay.
Yeah. I mean, J.J. Redick got off to a ridiculously cold start, but since he came back, he missed a couple games at the end of January. Over his last 13, he's actually right in line. Like, his shooting percentage, he's at almost 47 from three on 3.6 attempts per game. So it's good to see him just snap out of it.
But the volume isn't there. The volume, right. And that was a part of him. You know, when he was in Philly, you know, you saw that volume there. He was averaging 17.5 points on a high degree of difficulty in terms of 3-point shooting, and he was like the primary floor spacer. So when he doesn't bring the volume, you could argue like that's not what you need him for. Like if he hits one or two threes at high rate, okay, but you want him to take seven,
right? And I mean, at this point in his career, he's just not like you should not be. No contender should be starting JJ Redick. He is such a liability on defense that it's hard to balance what he brings offensively with that. You know, career 41.5% shooter, but especially in the playoffs, teams will target him every single time down the floor in pick and roll.
Right, right.
And defense, I think, is really the biggest concern team wide for the Pelicans. They're 29th in terms of defensive rating this year. They're sixth in offense. So, you know, again, like having the efficiency monster that is Zion Williamson and Brandon Ingram's shooting pretty well overall too. You know, that's not a huge concern for them with, you know, long term. I'm with you though. It's, you know, I think this year was always when you trade away a player as good as Jrue Holiday, this was always setting up to be a transition year where you want to get Zion. You know, this is really his first extended amount of playing time. Last year it was just in such fits and spurts that he, you know, every time it felt like he took a step forward, then he had to sit out a game or he was like limited to 20 minutes or whatever, and he was so productive in his limited playing time. But this is like the first season of him really unleashed, and they've recently been turning to more Zion on the ball, which has unlocked even more for them. So they're learning how best to use Zion and Ingram, which I think is the number one priority for this team this year. Wins and losses don't really matter all that much. It's just how do we maximize these two guys? Let's figure it out. And then we have the trade deadline, the offseason, you know, multiple years in the future to actually get the pieces around them that we need to really maximize their skill sets. I guess the question for New Orleans, you know, at a game and a half out of the play-in tournament right now, but still within striking distance, should they be a buyer or a seller at the trade deadline?
Oh, I mean, you could go either way. So there are different levels of being a buyer, Brian. You know, when people say buyer, they mostly connect that to veteran players, and you try to make a push for the finals. I don't necessarily look at, you know, being a buyer in that regard. You can still get a guy who is, you know, maybe in the start of his prime, who still has like 5 or 6 good years in front of you, so you can add that guy to the core. One example, a couple of years ago, when the Bulls traded for Otto Porter, for example, they at that point they were buyers, but they didn't go for a guy who was, well, it turns out he was basically near the end of his prime because right now he looks like a train wreck. But at that point in time, that wasn't the perception, right?
Right.
So you can be buyers in that sense. You can go out and get guys who are still perfectly aligned age-wise with Brandon and Zion, and just say, well, we are going to be sacrificing a certain level of assets because we feel that this particular player is going to be more suitable for those two. So in that sense, they could be buyers. But what they shouldn't be is, you know, championship buyers. Let's go out and get guys who are 32, 33. Like, no, that will be completely idiotic.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the rumors came out last month. Shams, I think, was the first one to report. JJ Redick is very much on the block. They were targeting one of the East Coast teams, so Brooklyn, Boston, Philly. I think the Knicks, someone mentioned them as well. So a guy like him who's on a $13 million expiring contract, who's already 36 years old, who, again, he's snapped out of the cold streak, but is still not providing a ton of value.
Right.
And, you know, is not part of the long-term core, could leave this summer anyway. That's a guy I think you almost have to flip at the deadline and just take what you can get for him, even though
agreed.
I think a lot of those, the potentially interested teams know the Pelicans don't have a ton of leverage and might be just trying to wait each other out to see if they, you know, can't find anyone, have to end up buying him out and get him that way, because that's far easier than acquiring him on the $13 million deal. Lonzo is the interesting one because Shams mentioned they were taking offers on him as well, but now he's been playing so well over the last month. You know, I think your dream of a Lonzo-Lauri swap has taken on some water lately with Lonzo playing this well and Lauri Markkanen hurt.
Not playing at all, yeah.
right, which has unfortunately been a common theme for him throughout his young NBA career.
I still think that deal made sense if you look at it from a long-term perspective because offensively, Lauri is probably what you need if you're the Pelicans. So here's a fun stat. Over the 32 games that the Pelicans have played this year, opponents have taken 250 more three-pointers than they have.
Yeah.
250. That is a major, major discrepancy? No. Disparity? I don't even know what the word is. Yeah. Okay, there we go. Dane in the house. Lauri would fix that. Lauri would come in and help that. I know that Lonzo was taking 7.7 threes, but I think ultimately Lauri is the type of guy who's going to end up taking far more, and he's going to take them in a different manner than Lonzo is, and he's just more inclined to be an offensive power than Lonzo is. Lonzo is more opportunistic. Lauri will look for his shots, or he will look for the three. He'll be the you know, 7-foot trailer. So this would give Zion more of an opportunity to illustrate his passing chops, Brandon too, for that matter. And look, the Bulls need a point guard. Lonzo Ball right now is playing a very stable brand of basketball. So yeah, I think it makes sense, unless of course the Pelicans are just looking at Lonzo going, you know what, we'll live with that. Maybe right. It's not important to have a do-it-all point guard because Zion is essentially going to transform into our point guard. And we have the playmaking Brandon Ingram as well. In which case, having a guy like Lonzo, who is an opportunistic shooter, would actually be the perfect fit.
Right. That's what I'm wondering, if he's kind of played himself into being long-term piece for them. Because I think for Lonzo, he can be a point guard in transition. He's certainly a good enough passer and is athletic enough to do that. I think the problems come more in the half court. But again, if you're not really as concerned with that because you're going to put the ball in the hands of Zion and Ingram more, then having Lonzo, who has really, really reworked his shot to, I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, it would be unfathomable to think this guy is shooting 40% from deep on almost 8 attempts per game.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a testament to him. And I think, yeah, it makes me wonder if the Pelicans are even entertaining offers. But if they were, and if they were interested in a marketed Lonzo swap, something tells me the Bulls would have to include a bit more to make the Pels interested.
Yeah. Now, ultimately, I think it's completely fair to reason that the Pelicans are going to hang on to Lonzo Ball and let him go into restricted free agency just to see what do we have there? Is there something we can work out where it makes sense?
They could always work out a sign and trade if the team, you know, is like offering him, but they can't sign and trade him if he signs an offer sheet. But if he comes back to them and says,
correct,
team X has offered me 4 years, $100 million, I'm going to sign it, but I want to give you a chance to sign and trade me first. That's certainly correct. An option.
Correct. And I think there's also this thing where the Pelicans also have to ask themselves how much of this is sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Because like you said, he's been on absolute fire. Is this just a hot streak?
Yeah. It's fair, and it's good of you to point out the three-point disparity as well, because, you know, not only are teams taking that many threes, but they're hitting a ton too. 39.4% is the third highest mark against any team in the league. They are hitting 15.9 per game. That's the most that any team is allowing. So, yeah, I mean, you know, part of it is certainly having Zion, who has taken 19 threes this year, and Steven Adams, who has taken one, having two non-shooters in your starting lineup, you're always going to be behind the eight ball there. But they don't really have a major three-point shooting big coming off the bench either. I mean, Melly is their best one at 24.1% on 1.9 attempts per game. So a guy like Markkanen would give them a different element for sure. But, I mean, again, if defense is one of their big concerns, a guy like Markkanen will not help as much in that regard.
Right, right. That's the big thing, right? I mean, the thing is, I almost wonder if the Pelicans would be better off just going the Dallas route of last year.
Yeah, just doubling down on offense and saying...
Yeah, almost. Because I do question the defensive upside of Zion to a certain extent. And allow me to elaborate on that, because I know Pelicans fans are going to be upset at that. What I mean by that is, if you are going to turn Zion into, ultimately, your version of Giannis Antetokounmpo, in terms of him being your just your primary guy, like, the guy has to take, you know, between 17 and 20 shots per game. He has to be your primary play initiator. He has to be the guy who takes all the abuse inside. And then you also need him to be your defensive anchor. That's a lot. And look, then people would argue, well, Giannis Antetokounmpo is doing it. Yes, and he's a two-time defending MVP and arguably one of the best players we've had over the past 20 years. Though not everyone is Giannis. And mm-hmm. and for Williamson to have that amount of burden offensively put on you, I wonder if, both in due to his conditioning as well, if he can also have the additional burden of putting in the effort and putting in the workload defensively, because that's just that's a lot of production he would have to give you every single night.
Yeah, yeah. So long term, I think it's safe to say both of us are not super concerned about the Pelicans. What do you think of their playoff chances this year?
I don't care.
I'm right with you.
They're so young, I don't care. It's fine either way. I wouldn't judge them on where they are in their process at all. I think they have their two primary guys. Now they're just identifying pieces to put around them. I couldn't care less.
I am right with you there. So I think that's a good place for us to wrap up. So thank you, as always, to everyone for listening today. As a reminder, you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. We are also on iTunes or wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We are being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And thanks for listening to our live show on Locker Room. If you liked our show, please be sure to start your own room and engage with other fans on the app. Download the Locker Room app in the Apple App Store to be a part of our podcast. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. Take care, man.
No, you didn't tell me not to die?
No. You know why? Because you're going to be a father soon.
So I'm going to want to die either way.
No. What I'm saying here is, when you are about to be a father, we're not going to be recording again in February. So, and next month, your child will come to the world, and I'm not going to be ending on a depressing note of just don't die. No, you have to live life now. You have to be an example for your son, and that means living life. No more dying. Now you have to live more than ever before, and sleep for the love of God, sleep whenever you can.
We're trying, man. We're trying.
Later, man.
Later.